RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Last week, you might have heard, or you listened on replay, we had our Phase 2 COVID inquiry panel with Dr. Guy Hatchard, Dr. Manny Garcia, Katie Ashby-Coppins, and Linda Wharton. And we were trying to unpack the recently announced Phase 2 of the COVID inquiry and asking the question, really, will it get the job done? Well, we're following on from that now. We're joined by Matt Shelton and Alison Goodwin, NZD SOS. Thanks for coming in, Matt and Alison.
Oh, you're welcome. I'd love to say it's a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
It is a pleasure, or you'd love to have the pleasure.
Well, here we are talking about the same old rubbish, and it's still going on. So it's never a pleasure to confront what we're dealing with.
Yeah, it never kind of ends. We're grinding through. Okay, so we're going to get to what you think about this Phase 2 inquiry and terms of reference and credibility, all those things. First up, though, has NZD SOS had any involvement with Phase 1?
Well, we were contacted actually just before Christmas last year, out of the blue, by the inquiry and asking if we were interested in talking to them. But it came with the same old list of restrictions of topics that were off, you know, off limits, and with that very narrow terms of reference. And of course, our core interests are, you know, the harms of the jab, getting acknowledgement for the vaccine injured, you know, medical ethics, and a lot of decision making made by regulatory bodies and government, you know, all of which was firmly off the agenda. So we actually sent them packing. We gave them a thanks but no thanks, and said exactly that to them. So it's been interesting to us that here that actually Voices for Freedom have had the opportunity to discuss some of those issues, actually. So, you know, I don't know whether it might be too late for us to sort of get, you know, get a foot in the door with Phase 1, because Phase 2, of course, is still too long away. You know, but we have some hopes and some fears, too, around what Phase 2 might be involved. But we saw it for what it was. We thought it was a whitewash, and the people who'd been recruited to willingly take part in the whitewash were unlikely to listen to anything we had to say anyway.
Yeah. Have you heard anything from anyone who has been involved so far, and have they described what the experience was like? Just curious.
Not other than Alia and Katie experienced last week. We know a lot of it has happened behind closed doors and seemingly in secrecy. But no, we haven't directly talked to anybody, I don't think, have we, Alison?
No, I haven't heard from anyone who's participated in it. I've looked intermittently at the website to see sort of who they're talking to and where they've been, but no direct experience. And yes, just to reiterate what Matt said, it seemed a bit pointless speaking to them at the end of last year when we were invited, because the things that interest us, the vaccine harm and the vaccine efficacy, were off the table. So those were the things we wanted to talk about. And it seemed to me, even if we were to talk about them, they weren't in the terms of reference, so it would have been a waste of time speaking about them.
It might just end up being that this is recognised as a kind of a waste of time.
Well, we, as you know, we've been very critical of the Phase 1 as it's played out. You know, we've written some very strongly worded posts, and we've called for the commissioners to be, well, sacked, essentially, for presiding over what, you know, what was never going to actually help the country, you know, move on and recover. And I've got to say, I'm slightly worried by some of the same messaging around Phase 2, you know, even perhaps coming out of New Zealand First, this idea that we've got to have this inquiry so we can do it better next time. Well, no, one of the things we've got to do is to make sure that, you know, a lot of this doesn't bloody well happen next time. You know, there's this sort of inbuilt assumption that we're going to get another, you know, another pandemic any minute. But we actually have to look at how this one has been allowed to play out, you know, how it was engineered. So much of it still doesn't make sense. You know, and in fact, we've got vast amounts of evidence now, you know, how most of what we were told was a load of rubbish right from the word go. You know, we have to make sure it doesn't happen again.
This talk of it happening again. We've had plenty of people on the station, total experts from around the world, who tell us overwhelmingly, I don't think I've heard anything different from anyone else, though I guess it comes down to who you have on, but pandemics are incredibly rare, global pandemics, really rare. Like you say, Matt, you keep talking of the next one. How do you explain that, that thinking when, if you're following the science, it's the least of our worries, probably?
Yeah, well, the word pandemic is one of many words whose definition was mysteriously changed in and around 2019, and conveniently in 2020 as well. You know, pandemic usually brings with it the notion of you know, mass deaths all over the place, and globally, and with the benefit of very early hindsight, actually. And since then, it was very clear that, that masses and masses of people weren't dying, despite what we were told, and that the mortality that was raised was limited to very specific areas of the world, and very specific demographics. And most of us were never at risk of you know, being culled by a sort of terrible thing, as it turned out. So, you know, a lot of this is the messaging and the marketing of, you know, what we should all expect, and then the sort of the fear and the disappearance of critical thinking and the frozen in the headlights sort of attitude that many people had, including, I have to say, a lot of the people in government and regulators, who were all, you know, very quick to just surrender to what they were told and get in behind and ultimately take part in a political rather than a scientific sort of narrative and pantomime. And that's one of the things that we've got to really investigate and figure out. How do we stop this happening again? How do we stop people from, you know, surrendering their own critical thinking? And in many cases, you know, decades of science experience and lots of qualifications to this kind of panicked groupthink that has seen, you know, the most dreadful injuries and suffering, you know, visited on our nation.
Alison, I haven't met anyone who didn't take the you-know-what, who talks about getting ready for the next pandemic. It is the language of a particular part of society. And that is, and I can see why Winston Peters would be using and others, that kind of deflects the very awkward point of what it really is. So to say, be prepared for the next pandemic, kind of, you're sort of skirting around the edge a little bit, is my impression. What do you think about that?
Well, yes, I agree. I mean, a true pandemic, you know, it has to be widespread, but it also has to be a severe illness. And they took out, you know, they changed the severity of the illness. So it just had to be an illness that popped up in multiple locations at the same time, but it didn't have to be severe anymore.
And you didn't have to be ill. You just had to have a positive test.
Well, yes. I mean, a case, what was a case? A case was a positive test. It wasn't a sick person. You know, we had a pandemic of positive PCR tests. We didn't actually have a pandemic of sick people. And we need to be very clear, I think, in the future, what actually are we talking about? Are we talking about desperately ill people, or are we talking about positive, you know, fraudulent tests when we define a pandemic? So, yes, I think a real, true, honest-to-goodness pandemic, highly unlikely to occur. And, you know, we keep forgetting about natural immunity. You know, humans have lived on the earth for however many years because we have immune systems. And our immune systems, if we look after them, will look after us.
Yeah, the point I was making is you can say, but we've got to be prepared for the next pandemic. No, you've got to account for why so many people are in such a bad way and not on the planet anymore. Actually, that was the point I was
right. Well, yeah, making. Yeah. Well, yes, we have to sort of unpack what happened in this last pandemic. And yes, we do have a pandemic of dead people. But, you know, what was the cause of death? That hasn't been hasn't been properly investigated, what all the people have died from. There's been incentives to label them certain things, but that's not been, you know, there's no scientific evidence of what people died from. A lot of that's been buried or not done.
Matt, you said that phase two was too far away just before. It's not that far away.
Well, I guess it's not, but, you know, it's slated to start in November, but then it'll trundle on and presumably it'll report, I suppose, sometime just before the next election. And if we're going to have to wait for the jab program to be stopped, for instance, until then, you know, whilst children from 6 months old upwards are now, you know, eligible for this vaccination, well, this injection, I beg your pardon, you know, that is too long. There is clearly a problem. Multiple lines of, you know, proof and evidence, you know, are all converging, have converged on the fact that, you know, it's very, very harmful, irrespective of how effective it was ever going to be. You know, it was forced on people, you know, with acknowledgeably no prior testing, you know, against established norms of medical ethics that, you know, again, in 2019, 2020, 2021, was suddenly pushed to the side so that this thing could be railroaded through. And another thing I'd like to see examined in this phase two is the part that the courts have played, because they've been, you know, only too quick to kind of get in behind the government and to ignore medical ethics. And it's exposed, I think, a kind of real gap in the law. And, you know, you could say, well, that's left to the medical council or doctors themselves to police. But that hasn't happened. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, and I've said this before, and I'll keep saying it. The only thing you need to know is that this thing was foisted into women of childbearing age, pregnant women, and especially children who were very clearly at virtually no risk from COVID-19. You know, that's about as hard a red line that you can get that was crossed. And the rest of it is, you know, secondary to that. And the other thing was that, you know, people could be injured or have had reactions and they couldn't get exemptions. And then it turns out that a whole bunch of people did get into exemptions on the quiet in the health system. So, you know, all of that, there's any number of things, much of which was in, you know, the excellent People's Letter that was, you know, handed in by Claire and Allier, of course. But, you know, really, this is going to take more. It should take more time than is allowed. And if we acknowledge that harms need to be covered, and it's notable the language that is used and still how reluctant some of these politicians are to actually use those words, vaccine harms.
Yeah. Well, they'll tell us about the next pandemic before they say that.
Well, that's right. But for the time being, why don't we stop this bloody thing? You know, other countries are ahead of us, and there are other parliaments now starting to say things like, we made a mistake. So the Philippines is having an inquiry at the moment, and there's some politicians there being very, very, you know, regretful and honest and saying, we made a mistake and we need to fix this up. And you have, in the last Japanese parliament, the interior... the internal affairs minister, so he would have been no slouch. You know, he has said recently in a public meeting that he now thinks that people were murdered. Whoa. So, you know, these people need, you know, they need to be acknowledged at least, and they wouldn't be saying these things, as risky as they are to say, you know, without being very sure.
Okay, I want to get from both of you, Alison, you can start. So this phase two, how would you like it to be presented? I've said before, and what do I know? But, you know, I would like to see something on TV or streamed continuously. I want to see cross-examination. I want to see all the names, even the ones we haven't heard of, all there. I want to hear the people's stories. I want them standing up, telling them, so I can watch and the people can watch. That's kind of my idea of it. What do you reckon?
Yep, that's exactly. I think it definitely needs to be public so we can see what's going on. I think people need to be summoned or called and expected to front up, not just invited with the opportunity to decline. They actually need to be called and swear an oath that they're telling the truth. We need to be able to see what they're being asked. And yes, cross-examination and with the ability for members of the public who may have sources of information to be able to put forward their information that might contradict what is being said. Visible so that we can watch it and see it. But yes, definitely public cross-examination and yeah, the ability to ask questions, the ability to summon people. Those are how I think it needs to be done. But yes, I've got lots of things that I want covered, but that's how it should be done.
We'll go into those in just a moment. And Matt, just quickly, your view on that.
Yeah, I'd agree with what Alison says. There will be, and there needs to be, a torrent of people telling their stories and proving to the rest of us, you know, the truth, the reality of the extent of harms. Because I think that's going to be very shocking for many people. You know, as it has been to us all the way through, you know, and it needs to be. And so if the inquiry doesn't have that mechanism And if it chooses, you know, from a small selection, it tries to sort of produce a representative sample of the types of things that, that you know, thousands and thousands of people have been dealing with. That will be a red flag to me. So it needs to take as long as it needs to take. But I think acknowledging the scale of harm is really what I want to see, you know, built into its structure.
All right, Alison, you've got a kind of a list of things. I know that that you've got in front of you, and some may or may not be covered by those broad terms of reference. Do you want to go through some of the things that, that you really want to make a point with?
Yes, sure. So they're just in a sort of random order. I haven't put them in any particular order. But I guess an examination of the experts, like who were the experts? Why were they all epidemiologists? Well, not all, but why were the, a lot of them epidemiologists who haven't seen patients clinically for years in most cases? GPs are the experts in treating respiratory illnesses, viral infections. And we didn't hear from any unconflicted GPs who were on the front line actually dealing with the real people, you know, with the issues before the vaccine came in, all the harms being caused there. We didn't hear from the GPs describing those. And then all the vaccine injuries, we haven't heard from the GPs. So experts, that was the point of that. But I want to investigation into ACC, and there, I mean, I've been privy to some of the ACC information behind the scenes, and the level of proof that ACC is expecting for people, I mean, the level of proof doesn't exist that ACC expects. The people that are applying for ACC.
What is the bar? How high is the bar? Just so we give a.
Well, they're expecting their gold standard randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials to prove that encephalitis is a side effect of the vaccine. Oh. Well, that level of proof doesn't exist. The people applying for ACC are the evidence. They are the proof. And in some cases, they haven't even been reported to CALM. Their cases haven't been reported to CALM, so we can't rely on the documentation we've got. You know, one of the first things in medicine is listen to the patient, and we're just ignoring what all these people have been saying. I was fine, I got the vaccine, now I've got these multiple issues. You know, why are we ignoring that? But yes, ACC, there's a huge amount to uncover there and unpack with what's, you know, how people have been declined, how virtually nobody's been able to get any compensation. Just the Bill of Rights. I mean, you spoke about that in the judiciary system. I mean, I guess I want to know, do we actually have a functioning Bill of Rights, and why are the judiciary not prepared to uphold it? And, you know, if there is a demonstrable justification for limiting our right to decline medical treatment, well, where is the document that goes through that risk-benefit assessment that's done to show that it's demonstrably justified? It seems to me that just somebody says, oh, yeah, it's demonstrably justified, let's do it. And there's no accountability. So, I mean, I want to see the document.
Who funds it all, too? That's the other thing. These institutions, like who's getting what from who? You know, that's another thing we probably need to know a bit about.
Oh, absolutely. Our universities, you know, because all the experts came from our universities. And where does the funding for our universities come from? And are the people that are the experts, are they having to toe a certain line? You know, certainly that was evident with ivermectin and, I can't remember his name, the chap that Tess Lowry had the dealings with, but his university got a huge amount of funding when he changed the ivermectin. Findings. So, you know, the funding of our universities influences, we need to investigate. Does it influence what the experts say?
An interesting thing happened. We had Gigi Foster on, who was on that panel on the Channel 7 COVID show a couple of weekends ago. And the epidemiologist official who was on that panel with her, she realized that he'd checked her out earlier on LinkedIn. And all he was interested in is what grants she'd got.
Right. Well, I mean, his funding, if we're talking about the Robert Boy chap, he's had a whole lot of funding from pharmaceutical industries, from what I've seen. So, yes, those things, I mean, maybe they're not an actual conflict, but they need to be disclosed that actually, yes, my institution receives funding from X, Y, and Z. Right, another bugbear I've got is this practicing medicine without a license. So a lot of our doctors have been censored for providing their professional medical opinions, and yet we've got a whole lot of unqualified people, politicians, media personalities, influencers, sports people, workplaces, all providing medical advice without a license. And I mean, how can the real doctors be sanctioned? And how can all these people provide medical advice and tell people to get a dangerous procedure without any assessment of the risk benefit or without any
understanding? With a smile on their face, Alison, with a smile on their face and the car park handing out vouchers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and but they don't have any concept of informed consent or what's involved. You know, telling someone to go and get a vaccine, in inverted commas, with no understanding of the implications of what they're doing. I mean, that needs to be investigated.
Yep.
But I better shut up because Matt's probably got a long list as well.
Matt, go for it.
Oh, look, it is. It's too long to sort of cover. But, you know, how is it that there's a torrent of proof of everything that we've been saying that's been coming out really since right from the beginning, that we've been informing our regulators, our ministers, our own professional bodies to absolute silence, and yet they're claiming that they're watching and they're not seeing anything that worries them. So, you know, those mechanisms broke down right from the beginning, that sort of communication, within the profession. That's really important. And also we need to make sure that people who've been working in the health system are able to come in and say what they've been seeing. So just in the last week, in the last 7 days, I've heard from an ultrasonographer who says that she is seeing a literal tidal wave of women, and especially younger women, with ovarian cancer. So they're sent in for ultrasound scans. And this has really stuck out like a sore thumb for her. I've spoken to four funeral directors who all confirm that, you know, business is booming. They've never been busier, but they've never seen as many younger people. They've never seen as many sudden deaths. They've never dealt with as many stillbirths. And particularly with young people getting cancer, you know, a lot of these people and these families have so little time to get their heads around what's happened from diagnosis to death that funeral planning, you know, is not happening. Some lawyers who do probates and things, you know, they've never been as busy either, but they're also dealing with and having to pass the public trust some of the time, you know, younger people who die without a will. You know, so people who've done their jobs for decades are all seeing different things. And that's what happened to us as well. We all noticed straight away changes and things that weren't normal and that stuck out, you know, in all domains, not just clinical, but particularly the ethics, the relationship with our regulators, and the absolute silence. So, you know, these are, you know, symptoms of whatever the underlying problem and cause is. And of course, we can only look at what's going on in New Zealand. But, you know, people's voices who matter have got to be heard.
Well, I saw a story yesterday in the media about the someone saying that the cancer treatment system in New Zealand is about to collapse. I wonder why.
Yes.
Well, you know, it's not a mystery. And we've been publishing for several years, you know, all the work that's proving mechanisms by which you might end up being more vulnerable to cancer than you were before 2021, February 2021, for instance. So, you know, this stuff isn't rocket science, and the evidence is building. And I think, you know, what this inquiry needs to show is what happens when the thing becomes too big to fail and everybody is kind of co-opted into this dreadful situation where they feel there's no way out and all they can do is just push forward and hope at some stage it'll all be over, but they're not going to be the first one that speaks out. And, of course, we're not going to wait till November. We've got the medical council in court in September, actually, you know, to find out the lawfulness of some of what's gone on. We're challenging the guidance document that said we all had to be vaccinated and that, you know, anti-vaccine disinformation would not be tolerated. And with that, most of the profession, it seemed to me, kind of moved aside and took their cue. And we know that there are many people in medicine who are furious about that, actually. They're not making enough, you know, enough noise, in our view. But a lot of harm's been done, and you know that will have taken place. But we may not have had the judgment by November. But I'm hoping that'll have an impact too.
It's just delaying an inevitable end game, though, isn't it? Because at some point, people. I mean, I just worry that, again, what do I know? That people will get very angry. Anyway, but the more it's suppressed I mean, I'm seeing people sudden death every day in the newspaper. I mean, no one can deny that. At some point, something gives. And the more you keep the lid on, the more the pressure builds up. So it can only get worse.
Well, look, it could be really ugly, but a properly managed inquiry is also needs to take account of, you know, the needs of the public. You know, they need to be led through a process of discovery, if at all possible, that, you know, takes account of their sort of, you know, shock and grief and surprise and anger. Now, look, who knows how this is going to go? And none of this is our fault. And maybe we're expecting miracles of this inquiry. I don't know. But you're absolutely right, Paul. You know, the longer it's ignored and suppressed and you know, the voices trying to call attention are attacked, the worse it's going to be for everybody. I think that's just human nature and that's history. It's very clear.
Yeah. Alison.
Yes. I agree. I think there's a giant bulge under the carpet and the carpet is getting too small to cover it up. But look, I forgot to say one other, my most important thing that I want
to investigate. Don't forget that. Yeah, please
and,
go.
And that's the whole pharmacovigilance and CALM and what's happened with the adverse events that have been reported. You know, how have they been investigated? I mean, as far as I'm aware, I spoke to CALM early on and they normally would see 3,000 to 5,000 or get 3,000 to 5,000 adverse event reports per year. In the first year of the COVID vaccine, they had 58,000 reports for just the vaccine. So I struggle to see how they could have assessed those properly. And from what I've been shown behind the scenes, they're not assessing. A lot of these adverse events, they might be recording them if they're lucky. They're certainly not going through any sort of causality assessment to determine was it or was it not the vaccine. So we really have no idea what the true numbers of adverse effects are. But I would say they're in the probably tens of thousands, at least thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not even more than that.
Well, they can't have the capacity to do that anyway, even in their dreams.
Yeah. So, you know, that needs to be a big part of the Commission of Inquiry.
All right. We're coming up against time. So how confident is everybody that this will do the trick, or is it too early to tell?
Well, my biggest worry is that something will derail this timetable that sees, you know, November as this sort of magical date when we can all heave a sigh of relief and expect, you know, the truth to come out, because we've got, you know, the drums are beating around a pandemic 2.0. You know, will it be bird flu? Will it be something else? Certainly in neighbouring countries, Australia and the States, they're already moving to, you know, attack the food chain and culling animals and claiming positive PCR tests rather than just letting whatever there may or may not be, you know, remembering that nobody has yet identified, as far as I still know, a single particle of this SARS-CoV-2 virus anywhere.
And there is that too.
And it's largely acknowledged. You know, you don't hear anybody arguing that it wasn't, in fact, a bioweapon, you know, released from the Wuhan lab. So why should we believe anything they say anymore? And yet, you know, they're beating the drums and talking about masks again and new vaccines and things. So we've got a long way to go. But I admire Winston Peters's sort of tenacity, because I imagine he's alone in that cabinet room.
Well, they must know. They know. Sorry to jump in over the top, Matt, but they must know. They'll know, people. It's a numbers game.
Well, and they also know what we've been telling them, you know, loud and clear for years, that we're just about to deliver another sort of notice of liability open letter, sort of summarizing all the new evidence since the last one. So you know, they can't say they don't know. You're right.
All right. Final words, Alison?
Well, I think it's probably a little early to say how confident I can be about this phase two. I mean, I'm glad that we've got acknowledgement that maybe phase one wasn't broad enough, but, you know, it remains to be seen who's actually going to be in charge and how it's going to be run, if it's going to be hidden behind closed doors, if it's going to be limited opportunity to get questions or get people questioned. If the wrong people are in charge, then I won't have any confidence in it. But hopefully all those things will, you know, we'll have good people in charge. It'll be open. It'll be public. We'll be able to cross-examine, and then I'll have more confidence in the findings and the outcome.
And Matt, on behalf of NZDSOS, you will be engaging. NZDSOS will be engaging in phase two, obviously.
Look, absolutely. And we may even contact phase one, you know, if they're willing and open, you know, to listen outside of the terms of reference because of the, you know, the way the tide's going. I'd rather not wait till then. But as Alison says, you know, we'll believe it when we see it, but we're certainly ready. We will just keep barraging them with you know, the data and the information that we need to have until then. We're absolutely keen.
Well, thanks for coming on, Matt Shelton, Alison Goodwin, doctors from NZDSOS. We were discussing the phase two of the COVID inquiry and the NZDSOS take. Thanks for coming on, and I'm sure this won't be the last that we talk about this.
Afraid not. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.